We need to democratize and disrupt the way that we do business. The number one thing that must be disrupted is the intention of man when it comes to business and for how we build and what we build for.
Hey, it's Steph Dixon, and welcome to the Live Wide Awake podcast. Thank you for being one of our amazing listeners in 88 countries around the world. Today, we're speaking with Christopher Lafayette, an emergent technologist, humanitarian in virtual and augmented reality, applying his talents to the metaverse, AI, medtech, education, Web3, and applied scientists. Christopher is the founder of Gatherverse that fosters conversations about what the metaverse can and should be to benefit humanity. He's also the founder of the Black Technology Mentorship Program, supporting entrepreneurs of tomorrow. And he sits on various advisory council boards, bringing thousands of communities and millions of people into the metaverse humanely. In this episode, we talk about so many things, but also the intersection of humanity and technology, AI, ethics, intentions and manipulation, regenerative approaches, innovation tipping the scale, and so much more. I hope you enjoy this smooth conversation, thanks to our sound partner, Audio Technica. Okay, it's time to live wide awake. Well, Chris, thank you so much for joining us on the Live Wide Awake podcast. I've been a fan of yours on LinkedIn for quite a few months now and really excited to deep dive more into your universe today. So I'd love for you to share a little bit about your journey and how you became an emergent technologist and humanitarian at the same time.
Sure, Steph, and thanks for having me and happy to be here. When I think about that question, there's a lot that comes to mind. There's a lot of material and a lot of things that have had to be woven for me to really arrive at this very moment to sit here with you and to occupy time that we don't get back. And for years now, I've been in technology and a student always, and a student of emerging technologies, and coming probably all the way since the times of just my general affinity since I was a child, of being around those that were heavily involved in technology in my family. My dad even being a technologist, an information technologist at that, and understanding intimately from him how the web works and why the web exists and for what reason. It's just amazing thinking about coming from the trips I would take with him to Cal Berkeley to go fix servers in the middle of the night and looking at how he operated with that whole network of hardware. I would often sometimes in my mind refer to him as a server whisperer because there was an interrelatability. There was some type of connection between that tool, that machine, and my dad, and seeing the way that he put together computers and took them apart, and people around the neighborhood and friends would ask him to fix these devices. And he'd be home hunched over with a little light on and going to work and building out motherboards and keyboards and databases and really understanding the fundamental placement holder that would transport the technological beginnings of what mankind has been developing is a fascinating consideration. Without the vehicle of hardware, we would have no space for software and we would have no foundation for expansive imagination. And so for me, I feel like I've come on the tail end of a journey that's taken thousands of years to develop in contemporary art time, decades, if you will, in the making of looking, going from an ideative phase to hardware and software scale to the natural next step, which is humanity. And considering that we've been in such a development phase of life, of my lifetime, if you will, it's multi-generational, but particularly in my lifetime, where I look at someone as myself as a self-proclaimed Zennial, dancing as a millennial and Gen Xer, if you will, in between, feeling like I had one foot in traditional and the other foot in digital. Some would call us the Oregon Trail generation. And coming from that space and arriving from that environment, looking at the baton that's been handed over, that's filled with opportunity of access that my predecessors didn't even have the opportunity and were afforded to have, I saw the opportunity to learn and to go further beyond working with just hardware, but understanding the nativity and understanding the meaning and the marriage pairing between, in some ways, I would say liberal arts and technology itself at that intersection and having an appreciation for it. And then taking it further to understand from whence all that comes, I would say, here on Earth, when we start to think about the input of human ingenuity and its influence and its inspiration to me is celestial. It's, in a great way, looking at it spiritual. And here, just building with these things, which are physical manifestations. And so how I came into this, I arrived to this without necessarily a specific intent, but I was driven by inspiration. And to become an emergent technologist wasn't something that was a thing that I saw to pattern after, because I've never known anyone to call themselves an emergent technologist. And for my affinity for understanding horizontally different technologies and applied sciences, I had to find something that I felt would fit the desire and what it is that I had found myself exercising in. And I just couldn't seem to find a title that existed. And so I went with emergent technologist. And there was a lot of time that went into thinking about that. And could I live up to that name? Could I define it? Can I express what that is? And can I really be that? Can I mean that? And so arriving to this moment that you and I are here sharing, it's fascinating to consider that the addition to an emergent technologist being a humanitarian fits so well with really so much within me to be able to express in some type of contribution through technology, through design, an opportunity to build a framework for the betterment of humankind. And so it's really an evolving title. Yes, the title is a fixture in name, but in terms of what its true in-depth meaning is, I certainly feel like I'm on an excursion yet to understand the magnitude of what this means.
Beautiful. Thank you for sharing. And let's zoom in a little bit about that better framework for humankind, because I think the topic of technology is inescapable. You know, it's already so integrated into our lives. Some people think that it is a silver bullet that will save us from the climate crisis. Others are scared about how it's going to take over and potentially rule us. So I'd love to just understand how you think technology can positively impact us first. And I love that you said that it was almost a spiritual journey. So maybe you can also unpack that a little bit.
Right. We're at a moment in time that where in some ways we have to realize that what's been developed and built and being consumed, public sector, private sector, and adopted today has been a framework that has been intentionalized for a very long time. And its intention in part has been the arrival of discovery to understand more of where we find ourselves at, whether in understanding the human body that we occupy or understanding the universe or even our solar system or galaxies that we're in, to understand so much of what we don't know when it comes to dark matter and dark energy and baryonic matter, if you will, and to understand physics, to take us to that next step in building these tools that will allow us, with the hope that will allow us to be able to take a deeper dive and a much more expansion into where we are, where we've been, and where we're headed. And so mankind, in so much of a way, has, in an incredible fashion, has built an incredible amount of tools, if you will, and we've all contributed, technologists or not. And it looks to be, in a significant way, a crossroad where I believe that most did not see coming and arriving this fast. And I say that because we're on the avant rise of the dawning of another renaissance from where we started in the 90s, if you will, and certainly technology and the descriptions therein and the intentions therein and really the ideation, even going back into the times of Aristotle, Socrates, Plato. But looking at the age that arrived in the 90s of the information age really propelled us into a space of what happens when a whole entire world receives information. And when we receive this information, not just here in Silicon Valley where I preside, but elsewhere also, but when we receive this information of the information age, this centralized information, we moved in such a lightning haste of development that in a major way, we didn't realize that we were building technology with industrial age standards. So we had one foot in this new nexus, but we had certainly everything else fundamentally and very old ways of doing things, and which subsequently led to a bubble. But after this bubble, several years later, a man by the name of Steve Jobs went on a stage in 2007, September, and said, I have this device called an iPhone. And within it are these things called applications, which applications weren't new, but in the fashion in which it was being demonstrated in the smartphone device, it was new. And not on top of that, we were heading and barreling into, here in the United States, a great recession. Yet, while so much of the world and the global GDP and so much of the global capital opportunities and markets were failing, the United States was ascending. And elsewhere, different places, a transmetropolitan, transcontinental, when it came to the development of technology. And soon we had Google coming out with different products, if you will, and to compete in Android and Microsoft and so forth and so on. And we saw a dominant vertical arising from a very dark time in financial history where major financial contributors that were powerhouses in this world were failing overnight. And so we saw technology ascended to the, what we now can look at as the Renaissance applications. And once the Renaissance applications took flight, we began to see platforms and companies become incredibly wealthy overnight. And so many of those people that were part of these failed Fortune 50 and Fortune 500 platforms huddled around together because they lost all faith and confidence in leadership to go back into a thing that they had just been expelled from. And they sat around tables and they said, hey, what do you have, Sarah? And Sarah says, I've got $10.50. And Bill says, I've got $7.25. And Jessica says, well, I've got $13.25. Let's create a startup. And so they created a startup and so many people did. And we have never seen a startup renaissance and culture happen like that based on their applications and web application platforms. And so that, which that information launched us in, we now found a more concrete and regimented way of developing and building with new age standards that weren't necessarily coming back from old wage standards. We were developing and innovating as we move forward. Partly we were able to do that is because we accelerated the narrative of communication and building tools. Over the past 20 to 30 years, the greatest development of technology undoubtedly has been the power of communication. And so now that we were able to communicate more expressly in video and in instant messengers and messengers and social media circles and groups, now we were able to share more, express more, and expand more in ways we had never been afforded the opportunity to do before. Now, as we move forward, what happened because of all these applications that have been built, it has allowed for others to take these democratized tools and now to create their own tools in a very simplistic fashion. And subsequent that, when we look at disruption begets accelerant and emerging technologies itself. So when we look at the greatest disruptor contemporary at our time, it's been no doubt COVID-19, which when we think and consider that, the greatest disruptor of our time wasn't technology at all. But it has made us and caused and forced us in some ways to use the technology that was sitting on the shelf. Things that weren't necessarily in vogue have become in vogue. And we've become more virtual in the past 39 months than we had the past 39 years. And so when we look at the arrival of these emerging technologies in an accelerated fashion that we see happening now with Web3, which we're really Web 2.5, but with Web3 and DeFi's and DAOs and dApps and NFTs and crypto assets and layer one, blockchain two, in the metaverse, if you will, and that other thing that we'll be talking about here in a moment, that now that people have access to these tools and have been building, it's not going to be of anybody, it shouldn't be of a surprise if we consider and have appreciation for our history and where we've come in such a short amount of time. It shouldn't be a surprise that we'll begin to see an accelerant offering of tools that in some ways were only things of fiction, and that many of us had talked about the possibility of being, it's now coming to pass. And so, as I had posed a question a time ago, what happens when the technology becomes more advanced than the technologist? That too has now come to pass. And so, in consideration of thinking about what we look at when we start to realize where we're at, we must begin to ask ourselves, in large parts, what will we do with what we've developed and built, and what are we prepared to pass down to generations to come? Because what we, many of us, were handed from our predecessors, certainly on a morphous scale, morphologically it's manifested different, will be so much dramatically different from what even our ancestors and our predecessors even envisioned. We did not consider that with what we were handed down. When we talk about artificial intelligence and we talk about the metaverse and we talk about cloud technology, edge, if you will, so forth and so on, that those were all single variable equations. But never did we consider the magnitude of what happens when these technologies abide within the greater ecohabitat itself, and that these technologies begin to scale and pair at the same time, which through this merge pairing really leads us into what we'll call true technological convergence. And true technological convergence on a morphous scale cannot be predetermined and defined, if you will, by mankind, because we don't know what the amalgamation will look like at the end of its rendering. And so, in such a powerful way of consideration, we have built much and more of the technologies that were in novels and in books and that were of literary works. But now we're heading into a very vastly unknown frontier that has its ceiling of mankind's comprehension of what could be as we move forward. And moving forward, we must.
Mm. So I read that while a lot of others are raising red flags about the pace of technology and change, and especially AI, you contend that we're actually not moving fast enough. So why do you think that is?
With this advent launch of, and with this dramatic arrival of artificial intelligence, where you see a technology adopted from 0 to 100 million users in a month. That's faster than Gmail. It took Gmail 5 years to obtain that. When we see this technology operating in an accelerated fashion, we have to really ask ourselves, look, why are we wanting to slow down? And I'm going to touch on a key specific point, because from my lens of what I look at and study emerging technologies and applied sciences, what I have noticed in the past 6 months is that two things specifically. One, the tempo of technology has accelerated and the cadence of technology has changed. And good technology is superseded by great technology, and great technology is superseded by better technology, which we commonly refer to as the disrupt. And we've now seen where whole entire countries tend to want to stop and stop the progress and halt the progress of disruptive technologies, only to their own fault and sometimes to their demise of loss, heavy loss, when individuals and governments and corporate organizations and whole entire countries attempt to slow down growth that cannot be slowed down by man, if you will. And I see it while much of the world at this very moment, as you and I yet sit and spend some time together, Stephanie, most of the world is in great contestation for those that understand what has just arrived at our shores with AI and generative pre-trained transformers, large language foundational models, in such a fashion that one side of the coin is saying we need to continue in this incremental scale as we've released it. And if any of us slows down, then we know that our competitors could at any given time accelerate past us, which is
one of the biggest causes for continuing to go forward. On the other side, the reason for slowing down is saying that we're moving too fast. We don't understand the nature of this technology. Sure, we understand simple AI, but have we progressed and are we at the doorsteps of AGI, meaning artificial general intelligence? Which we all know the next step, according to Bolstrom and others, would be superintelligence. Now, there are some scholars that do not know if we've reached already sentient artificial intelligence. And there are some that say, how do we even define now sentient? When we looked at the Turing test, and Turing said, well, these are the lines and the definitions of what a Turing test will be able to allow us to understand of whether a tool has become sentient. Well, first of all, what tools was Turing using to be able to quantify at the time of how we even look at sentient? And as Professor Hinton said in Vancouver, who's probably one of the greatest minds in the world on this technology, how do we define sentient? But the other part is that they're saying, let's slow down because markets aren't ready. Massive companies, they're not ready for this onslaught of what's happening and that the greater world hasn't even adopted. But here is my stance on it, is that I believe that we're not moving fast enough. I believe the faster we move gets us closer through the disruption than if we move stagnant and slow in the disruption. When you're in the disruption, there's a lot of things that happen bad because you're ill-prepared, you're not alert, you're not as vigilant, and you're not guarded. Many people do not want to operate their daily lives with a red light on of warning, but this is what we built and this is what we set ourselves up for. So we don't get to build a thing, introduce it to the public and to the world and not guard it with the responsibility of keeping up with it, else it will keep up with us. And I believe that we need to champion these platforms and products as opposed to taking the disposition of being timid and to hide behind the labors of what we've contributed as humankind and what we've been contributing for years, really arguably through the ages and dispensations of time. And so I am 100% for this and many reasons to continue to go forward as fast and as judiciously as we can to be able to understand, at least to some degree, to get on the other side of, oh, right, we've built this. Now what do we do with it? Because when we talk about the great concern, which is often the white elephant in the room of this whole entire conversation, is alignment. Alignment of all things. Will this artificial intelligence thing be aligned with human values? But I submit the question is, if it is aligned with human values, whose human values? That is the bigger concern for me. So it's not a question of will it align itself with human values, but whose human values will it align itself with? Because not all human values are the same, as you know, Stephanie. So now here we are on the line, and there are those that are saying, slow down. It's too much for us to comprehend. We've lost that privilege a time ago.
Yeah, and I think this is the big question around ethics and whose values are being adopted, because obviously there's been incidences that have blown up on the internet about how some of these AIs are really racist or sexist or peddling fake news, and these ethical challenges about who's actually coding in the back end or what materials they're learning from. And exactly as you said, like, whose human values are they? And the case of the matter is human values are also changing all the time. I mean, if we just look back about the amount of change we've had socially in the last 5 years, and now what finally is unacceptable, which was fine a few years ago. Well, not fine, but I mean, it was just accepted, but it's constantly evolving. So when it comes to sort of the ethical challenges presented by this new emergent technology, like, how can we begin to address that? Because I think that is the big elephant in the room, alignment, ethics, and how do we make sure that this is going to be a beautiful and safe space for people and not something that continues to perpetuate the polarization that we do experience already on the internet?
Sure. How apropos is that question? And lent and submitted to the chorus of those that are expressing like mind. When we think about policy and legislation and how fast at a pace that we're moving, It's amazing. I was just literally having lunch with an attorney friend of mine, brilliant-minded person, Bretton Heller. I know she doesn't mind me saying that. We were talking about legislation, and in some ways that this technology is moving at such a rapid rate, it's difficult for legislators to legislate. It's difficult for policy advocates to wrap their minds around, let alone, Stephanie, as I sit here thinking in real time, that even though they're using these generative pre-trained transformers, some don't know how to interact with it. They believe that this is a higher form of search. Some still haven't even appreciated the magnitude of what it is that they're interacting with, and some are slowly coming to appreciate. There are those that I've talked about just weeks ago, brilliant minds in their own way, and said, have you interacted with it? And they haven't. Let's say the 3, 5, 4, what OpenAI has made with GPT. And when I follow up with them and say, have you had a chance to interact with, some will let me know that they've interacted, and some are like, it's a game change for everything we've been doing. And I say, well, I'm thinking, no wonder I haven't heard from you in some time. You've been actively busy exploring in conversation this thing that has the capability to leverage its own self and its own data, if you will. How do you legislate that? How do you put policy on a thing that you don't even know exactly what it's fully capable of? What safeguards will we put around ourselves to be able to make this happen? I was in Atlanta not too long ago, a few weeks ago, if you will, sitting as an invited guest as a technologist with some brilliant-minded leaders in education. And one of them said, Kate, if you will, she said, well, a lot of teachers, I thought it was a great line. And it made a lot of sense. He says, a lot of teachers, which surprisingly enough, a lot of admin and a lot of faculty, they're for embracing these tools, by the way, in education. But some will raise hand and make hay and say, well, a lot of our students are using ChatGPT to cheat at our test. And Kate said, well, if you find yourself incensed, paraphrasing, or upset that your students are using GPT to cheat at the test, make a better test. So what does this mean? So presently at the moment, policy and legislators don't have the right tools to keep up with AI. So what they need to do, and what we need to do for them, is build them the right tools to keep up the game speed. You could take football, American football, if you will, and you'll have new college athletes that'll come into the fray. And when they were in college, they were the best thing since sliced bread. They were dominant, fast, and quick. When they get to the NFL, they're slow. They're stiff. They don't maneuver as well. Well, what is that? There's a thing they call, they need to catch up to game speed. And so that's what we need to do for our legislators and our policy people, because the reality is if we don't do this, there's going to be a backlog that's already on top of the slow wheels of justice, if you will, court system, a dramatic backlog. And there could be great showings of civil uprising, because we're talking about a technology that's slated in, just as Goldman Sachs said, very narrow focus to Goldman, this data that 300 million jobs stand to be displaced. I submit to you much more than that. Are we taking consideration UBI, universal basic income, and all the things that we need for sustainability? That's a really screaming big deal right now. And that is one of the reasons why they want to slow down, is because they all have said, many of these technologists, my goodness, what have we built? Because we are able to do the numbers and realize that this disruption, this isn't our common disruption. We're seeing high value positions, not fringe positions, of people being dismissed from these companies and corporations in droves. We haven't seen this type of activity since the bubble. And I say, well, what about the Great Recession? In the Great Recession, we were hiring technologists. In this present time, we were firing technologists. That was done in the bubble, because we don't realize that we've entered into a new age of renaissance when it comes to development. And we must create and we must innovate. From these ashes rises the champs, because now we will see innovators come back. Those that sat in the hallowed halls of all these different platforms now are stuck with the situation. I can't go back to school. I can't go back to college. I have a mortgage and all these bills to pay. I must innovate.
and innovate, people are already beginning to, and innovate, people will.
Mm. So how do you think that we can prioritize the creation of a more equitable and human-centric environment and this innovative space? Like, I guess also, where do you think we're going to be in 10 years? So if you think about where we are now, what we're creating, but like, what will it be like in 10 years' time? Will it be utopian? Will it be dystopian? Or something kind of in between, I guess, like where we're sort of at now?
I have to say, if this whole creation doesn't go up and is completely just done with, frankly, I mean, look what's happening on this face of this earth. There are great atrocities that are happening on the face of this earth. That even in our modern time, that one country can invade, with all the cameras in the world on it, can invade and kill hundreds of thousands of human beings and turn around and have a delicious cup of coffee the next day and celebrate in athletic sports and all different types of ceremonies. It is appalling to see. So to your question, which is a very important and very intimate question, Stephanie, doff of the hat, that there's a bifurcation. On one hand, I believe that we would like for it to be utopian. I believe that technologists think that what their technology is doing is going to help build a better world. And these are powerful inventions that have arrived. The problem is they get into the hands of the wrong people and very bad people. So at this moment, based on what we've seen adopted with current technologies, and looking at the great contestation we see happening on governments and civil society and people from all different backgrounds and all walks of life, we're more headed into a dystopian era than we are, and we are far from the reaches of utopian. Only in our mind do we really believe that we're going to really take the reins of the unicorn and go into this dystopian voyage, if you will. That can even be the intentions of the builder, but we must consider the relationship between the giver and the receiver. And not everybody will consume our products with the same intent of what we built them for. And that our products and our ideas can be hacked. And they are, in fact, being hacked. They are being manipulated. They are being changed. So 10 years from now, if it looks like what we're seeing today, this is going to be a very, very darker world that we find ourselves in. Now, through transparency and through different devices, we're able to see more on platforms such as TikTok and in some ways Reels and others, what's already been present, this way of mankind. This isn't the first time that warfare has happened. Warfare has been a thing that's happened through the ages and dispensations of time. But you would think, Stephanie, with all that we have here, with all the devices and democratized access, that that could be disrupted itself. That thing can be disrupted itself. And so far it hasn't. We stand a threat even now with nuclear threat, biological chemical warfare threat, cyber threat, and a whole manner of different threats that could be made by mankind, let alone the great devastation of this very, in some ways, volatile planet. Because I think sometimes we may forget that, wait a second, we live on a planet. And those things have a tendency to be very volatile that can create great devastation far more than what we see mankind do. So we're contending with that as well for our safety, if you will. So there's a lot of different levels and ways to answer that. Now, I believe your corporate CEO and C-suite will say, yeah, we just with all the optimism in the world. But the problem is what they have to stop. The only thing that needs to be paused and stopped to consider is, in business, is what have we built, what have we done, and how might we truly make this better? Because all the profits and the gain in the world will not be able to stop the impeding darkness and devastation and destruction that is headed our way because of what we built, because we ignored, we chose to innovate instead of ignoring the problem at hand. There's a price to pay for that. And so we've raised the flag of humanity first.
So how do we make sure that we don't continue to ignore and that we do, you know, prioritize humanity in this evolution that we're going through, or this renaissance, as you refer to it as?
In business, we need to keep in consideration of humanity first standards with everything that we build. We need to take advantage and adopt. We don't need to build new frameworks. There's already framework after framework that exist already that are well-founded and met, that are tried and tested and vetted, and sure, they can deserve to be tested and tried even more. But we need to bridge the gap of accessibility and education, community development, safety and privacy and wellness and ethics itself, to be able to understand that we need to democratize and disrupt the way that we do business. The number one thing that must be disrupted is the intention of man when it comes to business and for how we build and what we build for. If we only build for strong profits and products to be distributed, it continues to lead to the demise and the destruction of this planet. It continues to lead into the erosion of our communities that still find themselves without, our underserved communities. Now, in a lot of ways, we put a color on that, but this thing has transcended well beyond color. It doesn't necessarily look as color as the ultimate enemy that it looks to devour. It's people, it's communities, whole entire communities. Ecologically, I believe that what we could build that could be possible is by way of the metaverse, this virtual ecosystem of interaction and communication that we can build using decentralized assets, our own community environments, our own products, which at some point was considered quite libertarian wonderment, that we can operate within these virtual spaces and that people would actually want to operate virtually. That's no longer a consideration. It is literally a thing where we see product delivery teams and remote distributed workforces still working from the comforts of their living room. And some places have gone back and some are not going back. So when we think about the move forward when it comes to embracing humanity, from my lens, the number one thing that has to happen is we need to listen and we need to share and we need to form more communities that allow people to express. But we need to take that information at some point and leverage that for gain and begin to build based on that. There are living frameworks and prototypes walking around us every day and examples of what could be done and adopted. But we have such a development and a process for venture capital and angel investments and pitch decks and pitch competitions. And we've really missed the opportunity to uplift in some ways humanity on a social sustainable level by the power of invention. And we've limited the power of invention to only those that have the education or the knowledge intake or the access to innovate. And we have forgot about and become blind to those, the mass majority, by the way, of those who still remain, if you will, in the shadows and a lack of understanding. And AI is definitely the biggest and most destructive blow of what we've innovated that will impact us in such a fashion that this time next year will look dramatically different from all of us, the face of technology, of what we've ever known. And that's how fast this is happening. And so now, Stephanie, even though we call for the flag of humanity first, which in some ways we're judiciously and expressly doing from my side of things, and I'm not alone, I realize that the undertaking is too massive to convince the world, if you will, for the need for change. And I'm now looking and having an appreciation for those that have common desire, that want to see this change, and that we cannot take the current systems in which we operate in and deconstruct them to make them better. We now are forced in this world to build better systems that will supersede the present.
So it's such an interesting point. And I think this is something that I see so many activists coming back to in my circles. And it's the idea that, yes, our current capitalist profit-driven systems don't work. And yet the people who control the change, or I guess control the power and the money, they're so powerful that it's so difficult to even comprehend how we can supersede those systems. And so with all the work you're doing through Gathaverse and the conversations you're having with people and the work, you know, like, I guess you're so exposed to a lot of the people who are actually trying to make that change. how can we even do that? Is it possible? Do we have enough of a movement? Like, are we going to be able to supersede the systems before it becomes too dystopian?
When governmental systems and societal systems were put in place, republics or meritocracies, aristocracies, oligarchies, there's always a flip side to that. And the greatest governments of civilization have had their, through the ages, have had their ascendancy and their decline. And it wasn't necessarily by the will of the people that brought a civilization to decline. We're talking perhaps in the time of the Babylonians and the Medes and the Persians and the Grecians and so forth and so on. It wasn't necessarily by the will of the people that brought it to a decline. For the greatest enemy of the civilization was that civilization itself. If we continue to operate in the function and the fashion that we're operating, let's say the wealthy, as you put it, they will be their own demise. Just continue to operate as they will. Because they don't realize that they're innovating themselves to destruction. I think that sometimes we feel like we have to overcome that. You're absolutely right. How can we overcome that with the meager rations and the tools that we have available? Batman doesn't have enough utility in his belt to be able to overcome it. It's just not going to happen. But what we as those that are not wealthy, that don't have this type of access, that aren't necessarily leading these large companies and are ones that maybe aren't of the cast of people that are not mindful of what's, that are mindful of what's happening, the ones that aren't ignoring, the ones that do see, the ones that live it, all we need to do is control what we can control, if you will, and to build what we'll build. And when that decline happens, you'll start to see us naturally excel. Because while other platforms are degenerating, new methods that are up to the standards of today, contemporary to our time, are regenerating and excelling. That's why we're seeing a lot of things about regeneration and regenerative principles, because we're going back to first principles and saying, what have we missed behind? What have we left behind? People, humanity, plants, living things, if you will. And so activists will go head to head and demand change. And in some ways, their work is fruitful. I'm not a protester. I don't even look at myself as an activist, but I understand that everyone has a role to play and they must be allowed to play them. I say build and innovate, and we'll see which structural foundation stands the test of time.
Yes, great. I love that. Thank you so much. I think that I see this in sustainability as well right now. The companies that are prioritizing sustainability and slowly weaving it into their DNA are going to be the ones that survive. And those that are just keeping their head stuck in the ground and they're not implementing or changing, they will end up dying. So I think that was a very clear understanding. And I feel, I guess, more positive about it now with that understanding of, you know, there'll be destruction, their own demise, if they're not implementing these regenerative ways of building and technology for humanity first. So thank you for walking us through that. And I guess, like, you know, there's so much information in this space, so many changes that happen so quickly, and it can be a little bit overwhelming. So how do you sort of keep yourself sane and grounded and not falling into the trap of getting overwhelmed with the amount of information onslaught and the pace of this technology?
I think wellness is really important. Spiritual wellness and physical wellness. For me, they go hand in hand. And I've really looked at the 8 standards that we've developed, if you will, archetyped. I listed some earlier with between accessibility and ethics. And wellness is one of them. And I figure if we can hack a laptop, why can't we hack wellness? And when we see such headlines of the types of very disturbing activities that are happening in this world because of the suffering of mental illness, that I believe that a lot of us are met with apathy, that there's nothing that we can do about it. And sometimes it's thing even happens to our own selves, where we suffer from mental illness. And then some of us will begin to realize just how real this is. Anybody's subjected to it. It could happen to anyone, let alone having to take care of our physical wellness, our body. And sure, people have different beliefs, but to me, spiritual belief is everything for me. There's just nothing that supersedes it. And so I walk in grace and guided by grace and mercy. And I am so absent of tools, of things that can make probably my life even better. But I remain a student and humble to opening to what can make my mind and make my life better. And I feel like that's a 24/7 operation to want to be better, both spiritually and physically, because why not? Why not want that? Even for someone that feels that is joy itself, happiness herself and himself, why not want to experience even more, to do even better, to be better, to be healthier? You know, as we all of us age and our bodies will betray us, we've all experienced anabolism and we all will experience catabolism, which we cross that threshold of 25 to 26, as I've been told. And our bodies are subjected to going through anything. For me, building what we're building today in tech and in the world, might it allow us opportunity and space to focus more on what matters, which is inside? Might we find a way to disrupt traditional cycles of system for income so that we don't have to be so work ourselves so doggedly because we're forced to have income and to be able to afford a meal for us and our families? Think about the things that people do for money nowadays. Think about not just the crime, but the things that people have to do just to earn a living wage in this world. I don't even think I really appreciate, in fact, I don't appreciate the full magnitude of what that is. And so wellness for me is something that I'm proactively working on today. I'll be in Paris soon speaking at a rooftop wellness event with the team at Blemish to better understand what does the intersection of wellness and technology look like today. I'll let Kat out of the bag that we are working on a platform called Wellness GPT. With Gatherverse, we have a major event called Wellverse coming up, and it's something that's dramatically serious to me. When we talk about these events that we have, I'm just not as interested as I once was in a headset over the wellness of humanity. I just care more about that now, and I don't take away from those that may care about the other or equally.
Three things I'm taking away from this conversation with Christopher. Firstly, while the pace of change in technology can be a little bit scary, by going back to first principles and prioritizing regenerative approaches, we can see the scales tip and the old systems begin to crumble and self-destruct. Secondly, we need to remember to consider the relationship between the builder and the user and be mindful of intentions and manipulation. And thirdly, let's always remain a student, stay humble, and be open to being better. I'm curious, what did you think about the episode and what were your main takeaways? Is there a topic you want me to dive deeper into? I'd love to hear from you. You can find me at Steph L. Dixon or at Live Wide Awake. If you got something out of the podcast and you want to continue this journey with us, consider subscribing and supporting. I hope that today's conversation stirred something deep within you, ready to awaken. And until next time, live wide awake.